VOA News, I'm Tommy McNeil. There is reaction on Capitol Hill to the arrest of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Just hours after British police dramatically arrested him at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had been holed up for nearly 7 years. Assange is held responsible for a computer hacking conspiracy linked to the release of hundreds of thousands of secret U.S. documents. Democratic U.S. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia says WikiLeaks founder Assange should be held accountable.
They've acted in concert with the Russians to interfere in our elections. They helped either hack into or took hacked information from the Russians and released it in a way to disrupt our campaigns in 2016. And I don't think that's not right. I think that's illegal, and I hope Mr. Assange gets prosecuted.
And Republican Senator John Kennedy on the matter.
He's under indictment, and I'm pleased to see him arrested. I can't speak for the president's comments. I haven't heard. But we have due process in this country. We'll have a chance to defend himself.
And the indictment of Assange stems from one of the largest breaches of classified information in U.S. history. The 2010 WikiLeaks release of a vast cache of U.S. military records from its wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, assessments of suspected terrorists held by the U.S. at its prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and 250,000 State Department cables. The Taliban says it has temporarily stopped the International Committee of the Red Cross and the World Health Organization from carrying out relief work in the areas it controls in Afghanistan, and it has revoked security guarantees for their staff. The Islamist insurgent group alleged in a statement that it has found WHO staff involved in some suspicious activities during vaccination campaigns, and that the ICRC failed to practically implement pledges given to the Taliban. This is VOA News. Experts are now saying that North Korea might begin turning away from South Korean President Moon Jae-in after he failed to secure sanctions relief from U.S. President Donald Trump during his visit to the White House. But as VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman explains, there's still room for more progress to be made.
Sitting alongside South Korea's president, U.S. President Donald Trump expressed willingness on Thursday to hold another summit with North Korea's leader to try to reach a sweeping denuclearization deal. There are various smaller deals that could happen, Trump said to a reporter in the Oval Office when asked if he could accept any agreements shy of denuclearization. South Korean President Moon Jae-in told Trump that the first summit the U.S. president held in Singapore with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last June led to a significant reduction of tension on the Korean Peninsula and that there is a need for a third summit. A second summit in Hanoi earlier this year ended prematurely with no agreement. Trump declined to say if he had been in communication about that with Kim in recent weeks. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
A plan by Sudan's military to take over the country's government is getting a cold reception from protesters in the international community who want to see the African nation take steps toward democracy. Sudan's defense minister announced the takeover on state television Thursday after the army ousted the country's longtime president Omar al-Bashir, following months of demonstrations against this 30-year iron-fisted rule. A transitional military council will run the government for the next 2 years. A 3-month state of emergency has been declared, along with the suspension of the constitution and dissolution of parliament. Earlier, a Sudanese military source told VOA that al-Bashir, who's 75, has been put under house arrest. Pro and anti-Brexit supporters have vowed to step up their campaigns after European Union leaders gave Britain a 6-month extension to the process of leaving the bloc. The extension of the so-called Article 50 process averts immediate concerns of Britain leaving without an exit agreement with the European Union. The new deadline is now October 31st. The delay could mean that Britain will take part in EU elections scheduled in May, and there are still few signs that British lawmakers will approve Theresa May's proposed Brexit deal, further prolonging the political process and chaos. Tibetan spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, was discharged from a Delhi hospital Friday after a chest infection. The 83-year-old Nobel Peace Prize winner, who was brought to the capital from his base in a northern Indian hill station for treatment, had recovered from the infection, according to the media. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudanese President Bashir has been ousted by the military, but the protesters are rejecting the military transitional roadmap.
The Ummah Party, we will demonstrate on the streets of Khartoum and Sudan. We will work with all our partners inside Sudan and outside Sudan to remove this regime.
Mohamed Al Ansari is the prominent member of Sudan's opposition Ummah Party. Sudanese Americans also reject a military-led transitional government. South Sudan says the change of government in Sudan will not impact the relationship between the two countries. Pope Francis cases defeat of South Sudan's warring leaders, and civil society activists in Uganda say they want a law that will regulate the financing of election campaigns.
People are seeking elective positions, not to serve, but to make money. And we think this is the wrong direction as far as democracy is concerned, because democracy is supposed to deliver leaders who are accountable to the people.
Frederick Awuya works for the international NGO ActionAids. Zimbabwe announces a process to compensate white commercial farmers, and Nigeria's population is projected to double by 2050. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's opposition has rejected the transitional roadmap announced by the defense minister, who led yesterday's army overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir, saying it does not meet the demands of the popular protest that swept Sudanese cities for the past months. Dr. Mohamed Al Ansari, a prominent member of the opposition Ummah Party, says the opposition demands a civilian-led transitional government that will eventually organize credible elections.
What is happening in Sudan is the same situation, but the regime comes on a new forms. Unfortunately, the army does not like implement the call of people of National Congress to step down. When people just starting this in December 2018, we are entering the month number 5 now. They requested the old regime to remove Omar Bashir. And Ibn Auf of National Congress Party and is a part of Muslim Brotherhood. It means like the regime just changed the faces, but they didn't change the system. So the situation now in Sudan, people are continuing their demonstrations. They are demonstrating in front of the Ministry of Defense, Army Headquarters, and they are continuing to call for the regime to step down and to start the transition period for 4 years, leaded by forces signed or the signatories of Declaration on Change.
Does the Ummah Party support the timetable as outlined by the Minister of Defense and Deputy to Omar Hassan al-Bashir?
Ummah Party supporting the Declaration for Freedom and Change. Ummah Party called for a transition period for 4 years, not 2 years. This now, they said the army will be controlling the country for another 2 years, which is this what people, they didn't go out to the street to asking Ibn Auf or asking another face of this current of the regime in Sudan to come and rule. So people, they need a genuine change, because Sudan separated by this regime in 2010. This regime committed suicide in Darfur. People of this regime abuse the resources of the country. The people of this regime, they have the blood in their hands. And also, they are very corrupted regime. They abuse all the country resources. Sudan is a big country and we have a lot of resources, but unfortunately, people live under the line of poverty.
Is the Ummah Party calling on Sudanese to continue with the demonstration, since you said that this is a second coup within the same administration led by President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who stepped down Thursday?
Yes, our ask is the same. All of us now, we are working under the same umbrella of Declaration of Freedom and Change. Now we are asking this regime to remove the new regime, or the second version of NCB regime. It has to be removed. It has to go now. If they will manage to remove Bashir, why they can't manage to remove Ibn Auf now?
What will the Ummah Party do to force another change, since you said this is just cosmetic and not a real change?
The Ummah Party will stand with people. We will demonstrate on the streets of Khartoum and Sudan. We will work with all our partners inside Sudan and outside Sudan to remove this regime.
Dr. Mohamed Al Ansari is a prominent member of Sudan's opposition Ummah Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital Khartoum. Many Sudanese Americans have joined with the opposition political parties to denounce the transitional roadmap announced by the country's defense minister, who led the army overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir. Ahmed al-Mubarak is a member of the Sudanese American opposition. He explains to viewers senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi the reasons for their rejection of the transitional roadmap.
We don't see this as a transition in any form. It's basically a reinvention of the existing regime and an attempt to secure the interests of the regime's associates, partners, and members inside and outside of Sudan.
Sudanese Association of Professionals rejected the defense minister's announcement, and people now are waiting what could happen in Sudan if protests continue and the army is sticking to its plan.
The SPA, the Sudanese Professional Association, definitely, rightfully so, they did reject the announced takeover by the defense minister, and the entire Sudanese community did. The protesters in Khartoum right now are totally against this, and they intend to continue with their resistance. This is not over.
So do you share concerns that removing al-Bashir is leaving behind a deep state that will never meet the demands of the protesters?
When you listen to the statement that was given by the defense minister, the reasoning that he gave for taking over and arresting Bashir in a safe place was because of the cracks that it started to show within the institution of the military. That's basically the entire motive for them to make this change. It's not intended to improve the status of the country or the well-being of the people. So what he has done is basically disabled the 2005 constitution, and now he's announcing a state of emergency and a curfew starting at 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. So state of emergency, you have to have a reference. It is guided by a constitution. So now you're saying the constitution is disabled. You are completely dismantling the legislative body. So what is this state of emergency? What is the legitimacy of it? And what are you actually presenting here? So this is entirely a fabricated transition, intended nothing other than to secure the well-being of the members of this regime, as well as the interests of the external entities or parties that have shared corrupt interests. That is basically, if this transition was to happen and this government was to fall, then the new government, the Sudanese government, would no longer be bound by the agreements. He wants to protect those agreements. And I think this is what's behind this. This was fabricated to protect those people that benefited from these types of dealings inside and outside of Sudan.
Ahmed al-Mubarak is a member of the Sudanese American opposition. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi. South Sudan says the change of government in neighboring Sudan will have little or no impact on the relationship between the two countries, as well as on the implementation of South Sudan's revitalized peace agreement. Niao Deng Niao is South Sudan's Minister of Foreign Affairs.
First of all, we respect the will of the Sudanese people, and as a sovereign state, whatever happens in the Republic of Sudan is really the business of the people of Sudan. But of course, we are aware at the same time that we are neighbors and our relations are very, very important for both Sudan and South Sudan. And we believe that this relationship actually transcends the political leadership. And so regardless of what happens in the Republic of Sudan, we would not see that as negatively impacting in any way the relations of the Republic of South Sudan.
What do you mean to not negatively impact you guys in any way? Because Bashir has been at the forefront of looking over the peace process.
It's true that Bashir, especially in the last stages of the high-level revitalization forum process, played an instrumental role alongside President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda. But when I say that relations are not necessarily going to be impacted in any adverse way, it's simply because both the Sudanese and the South Sudanese as people are convinced that their mutual interest dictates, mandates that they coexist peacefully side by side and benefit from one another.
From the government's point of view, what do you think has stalled the peace process? Why is Riek Machar, for example, not in Juba at this point?
Well, Riek Machar is not required to be in Juba at this point in time because according to the provisions of the revitalized agreement on on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan, Riekis will be required to come to Juba when the government is actually being formed, and that government is not due to be formed till the middle of May this year, and so that's the time when he will be required to be in Juba. But you have to understand also that members of his team, his colleagues in the leadership of the SPLM-IO are already in Juba. Not only them, but even leaders from the other political groupings that are in Juba, and they are working together hand in hand to implement the provisions of the revitalized agreement.
Niao Deng Diao says South Sudan's Minister of Foreign Affairs. He spoke with U.S. Paul Ndiho in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 12th. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. Pope Francis has told leaders of South Sudan's warring parties that peace in their country is possible, and he urged the country's leaders to seek what unites and overcome what divides them. At the end of a two-day meeting in the Vatican, the Pope shocked those present by kneeling and kissing the feet of South Sudan's former warring leaders. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
At the end of the two-day meeting in the Vatican, originally proposed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, Pope Francis told South Sudanese leaders to recognize the enormous shared responsibility they hold for the present and future of their country. Those attending the meeting included South Sudan's President Salva Kiir, Vice President and former rebel leader Riek Machar, and three other vice presidents. The Pope called on them to commit themselves to the building of their nation.
La gente è stanca ed esausta ormai per le guerre passate. Per favore, ricordatevi che con la guerra si perde tutto.
The Pope said, people are wearied, exhausted by past conflicts. Remember that with war, all is lost. Your people today are yearning for a better future, which can only come about through reconciliation and peace. One of these South Sudanese religious leaders attending said these were days of intense prayer and deep reflection and of open and frank dialogue and spiritual conversation.
The leaders leave here renewed and committed to the task of working for peace, striving for reconciliation, and seeking justice for the 13 million people, the South Sudanese, whose prayer and hope they all carry.
Pope Francis told them how he learned last September that a peace agreement for the country had been signed and congratulated political leaders for having chosen the path of dialogue. He urged them to implement what has been agreed on. After his speech at the end of the retreat, Pope Francis kissed the feet of the former warring leaders and told them their people are waiting for their return home, for reconciliation and a new era of prosperity. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Civil society activists in Uganda are calling for the enactment of a law that will regulate the financing of electoral campaigns. Their demands have been reinforced by renowned African analyst and human rights lawyer P.L.O. Lumumba, who says the only way to control what he calls the commercialization of elections in Africa is by empowering the citizens socially and economically. Mugumi Davis Rakavinch reports from Kampala.
Norman Tumhimbise, who heads the Alternative Youth Movement in Uganda, says excessive use of money compromises voters' decisions during elections. He says leaders usually bribe voters to vote for them.
When a candidate gives in money, he has already bought your services already. So every time he gets an opportunity to get the money, he will never implement services. He will use that money because he already bought you prior to the voting date.
He says once elected, leaders engage in corruption practices to recoup what they have spent during campaigns. Frederick Kawoya works for Action Aid, an international non-government organization whose primary aim is to work against poverty and injustices, agrees.
Democracy is getting lost in Uganda, and what we have is a commercial relationship between the citizens and those that are elected. And we think that is the point at which we lose the essence of people voting leaders to serve them. People are seeking elective positions, not to serve, but to make money. And we think this is the wrong direction as far as democracy is concerned, because democracy democracy is supposed to deliver leaders who are accountable to the people.
He says as members of civil society, they are going to petition the parliament to make laws that require those seeking elective offices to declare the sources of funding and provide accountability to their spending. Speaking at a public lecture in Kampala this Thursday, Patrick Loch Otieno Lumumba, a professor of law from Kenya, said voters must be educated of their rights.
When people know that they have good health care system, that they have good education, that they have opportunities, the way they think changes dramatically. But when people are reduced to a situation where they don't know how to get the next meal, their preoccupation is the next meal, and the provider of the next meal becomes their God.
Civil society activists here say once they have gathered signatures, they will petition the parliament to debate on a law governing election financing. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
After several years of debate over whether to compensate white farmers who were forced off their land in 2000, Zimbabwe's government announced this week that the process was underway. Nick Magwana, the permanent secretary in the Zimbabwe Ministry of Information, says the government is compensating farmers in accordance with the constitution and that the compensation will be fair.
Government position regarding land is that the procurement of land right now is not a racial issue. It's not a question of a black farmer, a white farmer, or whatever color of farmer. It's a question of a Zimbabwean applying for land, and it's assessed accordingly, and if they deserve land, they'll be given land by whatever criteria that is. But at the moment, the government is seized with the issue of land audit so that we can unlock either underutilized land, multiple farm ownership, or humongously big farms which are owned by one person, which we need subdivision. That is the current government policy.
And when is the government likely to conclude that audit?
They recently got an extension. I'm not sure when it will be completed, but we want a thorough process and a thorough outcome. So because of that, there's no need to be rushed, but they are working diligently to ensure that happens in a timely manner.
The farmers are also saying that their compensation, if it includes land and the developments on the farms, might reach $9.5 billion to $10 billion. Any figure from government in terms of its own evaluation?
No, this is what is being worked on, and they will be concluded by end of May. But the point is, our constitution and law is very clear that what government is compensating for are the improvements and developments that were on the farm, not for the land itself. So I'm not sure where they are. The calculations would involve the land itself, because that's not part of the equation.
Nick Magwana is Zimbabwe's permanent secretary of information. He spoke from Harare with Blessing Zulu of View Zimbabwe Service. With Nigeria's population growing at more than 3% a year, authorities are offering free family planning methods and advice to Nigerian families in an effort to slow population growth. Nigeria, which is already the most populous country in Africa, is projected to have more than 400 million people by 2050, doubling today's number. Timothy Obiezu has more from Abuja.
30-year-old Esther Ndubisi has 7 children. Her youngest child is only about 8 months old. She says her partner, a painter, barely makes enough to feed the family of 9 and cannot afford to send all their children to school.
To pay their school fees, sometimes self even bring problems between me and my husband.
Nigeria has the largest population in Africa, and it is growing at 3.2% a year. The U.S. Census Bureau says at that rate, there will be an estimated 402 million people in Nigeria in 2050. The major triggers for population increase include early marriages, high birth rates, and lack of family planning access. But cultural and religious contributors are also impacting significantly. Family planning activists such as Ejike Oji worry about uncontrolled population growth.
Number of people we are producing every year is faster than our development rates. And that's why Nigeria has now become the number one country with the highest number of poor people.
But that could change. A project by the non-profit Planned Parenthood Federation of Nigeria is providing family planning methods and advice across the country. The non-profit is in collaboration with the Nigerian government on the project. Program officer Ada Iluno says it is making an impact.
When we go for outreaches, we seek out for rural areas where we know that the uptake is quite low and the need, your met need, is very high. Based on our operations, we've seen quite a lot of results. where we see high turnout of women.
The average family size in Nigeria is 5.6 people, but many families are larger, especially in the north, where polygamy is common. The government is trying to encourage smaller family sizes in order to secure Nigeria's financial future. But experts say until social structures like education and health are improved, the odds are that Nigeria's population will continue to increase and may even surpass the 2050 projection. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the 24 teams who have qualified for this year's African Cup of Nations and who are bracing themselves up for the draws, which will indicate the groups they will be competing in and which sides they will be up against. The heads of federations as well as the national team coaches are already in Cairo for tonight's draw as the Confederation of African Football begins the 100 days countdown for the June 21st to July 19th tournament. The 24 teams are divided according to the latest FIFA rankings, while the results at the previous three African tournaments in 2013, 2015 and 2017, as well as the results of the past three African qualification campaigns, will be taken into consideration. Jero Udo and Andrew Randa are sports journalists.
The fact is that every of the team that's supposed to be in the Nations Cup is there except Zambia. Every of the team, name them Senegal, DR Congo, Ghana, all the big teams are there because of the expansive nature of the Nations Cup. So the Nations Cup is going to be very, very interesting. The first time we're having 20-team format, 24-team format, and we're going to have the round of 16 for the first time in the Nations Cup. So that tells you that it's going to be a very, very exciting and interesting competition.
What I do know is Nigeria is going to face a very tough team, a top team, and then maybe two of the minions, like the other guys, the Burundi and Mauritania, that have qualified. And after I did my simulation, more or less, I found out that give or take, it would be an easy passage for Nigeria to the quarterfinal.
Away from the CAF African draws to the CAF Champions League, as Al Ahly manager Martin Lazarte has announced a 21-man squad ahead of their clash against Mamelodi Sundowns in the CAF Champions League quarterfinal second leg. Sundowns had trashed Al Ahly 5-0 last weekend at home, and the Reds will be hoping for a miracle in the second leg to compensate the first result on Saturday. In other games this weekend, Esperance de Tunis will be confident of sealing a place in the final four of the CAF Champions League when they host CS Constantine. Simba SC will be out to cause a major upset when they lock horns with TP Mazembe, while in Omdurman, Etoile du Sahel will look to avoid an upset against Al Hilal, while Casablanca will look to make the most of the home advantage when they host Horoya AC. The team's first leg meeting at the Stade du 28 September in Conakry ended in a goalless stalemate. And now to South Africa, where English Premiership side Arsenal have been in South Africa for a three-day coaching clinic for coaches in Cape Town and South Africa, known as Coaches to Count, a social awareness campaign. Simon McManus is Arsenal Academy coach and is the lead facilitator for the coaching clinic.
Sorry, we're not telling the style we want them to coach. We're trying to get them to understand the different principles behind the way we try to create holistic players at Arsenal.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And briefly before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Omar al-Bashir, the longtime president of Sudan, was ousted by the military on Thursday after 4 months of mounting demonstrations against his rule. Speaking on national television, Sudan's defense minister, Awar Mohamed Ahmed Ibn Auf, announced what he called the toppling of the regime. He said al-Bashir had been arrested and was in safe place. The defense minister said a transitional military council will run the government for the next 2 years. And that is it for this Friday, April 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour. Tune in for a summary of the news At the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America, hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has made headlines for pushing through unprecedented reforms. But many challenges lie ahead in creating a national consensus. Discussing Ethiopia's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.